Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, pledging to help end child hunger in the Carolinas through ongoing support of Second Harvest Food Bank of Metrolina. Details about this initiative at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, Mecklenburg lowers the bar for lowering masks, but the number of positive tests rises, so the mask mandate stays. North Carolina is about to get a budget. Well, we actually got one last night. Governor Cooper signed the long-delayed budget despite what he called missed opportunities. Changes afoot politically in North Carolina with district switches and congressional retirements in the offing, and parents hold a town hall on guns in schools. Our area gets some infrastructure money. McRae Dowless rolls the dice, and Cam Newton might really be Superman. Here to bring us up to date on those stories and more is WFAE's political reporter, Steve Harrison. Good morning, Steve.
Hey, good morning, Mike.
Mary C. Curtis is a columnist for RollCall.com and host of their Equal Time podcast. Mary, welcome.
Good morning, Mike.
Katie Peralta-Soloff is a reporter for Axios Charlotte. She returns triumphantly. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
And Joe Bruno is here from WSOC TV Channel 9. Joe, thanks for being here.
Hello, Mike.
Well, we've all been getting ready over the last couple of weeks for the mask mandate in Mecklenburg to fall. They changed the metrics for ending the mandate from a 5% positivity rate for 30 days to 4.99% for just 7 days. But the rate of infection isn't cooperating. It's been slowly rising. And when I talked to Mecklenburg County Health Director Gibby Harris the other day, she said that rate had gone from 5.2% on November the 8th to 6%. This past Sunday, and she also told me that hospitalizations here are ticking up. Gibby Harris told the Mecklenburg County Commissioners on Tuesday that the reasons for this increase are not clear.
We're continuing to watch this over time to see if these are trends or just some increases that may have been related to Halloween. We're not sure at this point.
So are health officials worried that this is the beginning of a new surge?
Maybe, but again, we got to wonder what the surge will look like and what exactly surge means, because now we have more people fully vaccinated and we have a good amount of people who now have three doses in their arms. So will we be looking at another surge amongst the unvaccinated? I think that's what we're kind of waiting to see. And when we even say surge, is that even appropriate? Will it be a spike? Like what, how will these numbers compare to the Delta wave? And then of course, last winter. So I think that we could see a rise in numbers, but it's unknown what exactly that will look like and the impact it will have on our community.
Because other parts of the country are experiencing an uptick in the number of cases and the number of hospitalizations. Several European countries are already experiencing a surge. In fact, Austria announced that they're shutting down, I think, this week again, and that they're going to have a virus vaccination mandate next year for everybody in the country. And Gibby Harris told me the other day, this is the time of year this is going to happen. Viruses love winter. They love cold weather. They thrive because people go indoors in groups to stay warm. We're heading into the Thanksgiving and later on the Christmas holidays, which promise to be enormous for travel and get-togethers. Are we getting any warnings from health officials, or are they still okay with people getting together for the holidays? I'm not sure who to ask that question of.
Well, Gibby briefly went over her holiday guidance, and she did not tell people to stay at home like she did last year. She did say, make sure that the people you are gathering with are fully vaccinated. And I believe she also said she's hoping for some warmer weather. So for Thanksgiving coming up, hopefully you can have that meal outside.
It's a difficult question, because after last year, there's a pent up desire for travel and to get together for the holidays. And even the health officials know that people just want to get together, and being that they're going to be indoors with some members who are vaccinated and some who are not, that is really worrisome for them. But, you know, people are going to get together.
Yeah, and Gibby Harris told me that almost everybody in the hospital locally right now, and it's upticking, almost everybody there is unvaccinated. And at the county commission meeting on Tuesday, she offered some guidance for the holiday season.
We need people, if they're eligible, to get vaccinated. We need people to get their children vaccinated. We need those who are eligible for boosters to get vaccinated.
So where have we heard that before, huh? Are people heeding that advice, and do those who are not heeding it yet and who continue to complain about wearing masks and about the inability to return to normal, do they understand that they are the cause?
Possibly, but I'm not sure they care. And I think that right now, the biggest one point that we could take away that we're seeing with the vaccination numbers is our numbers are a little higher. They're much higher than they were the last wave, but the most of the shots being administered right now are booster doses, which are especially important for the seniors in our community. So I think that if you're gathering with older individuals, you should really make sure that they have their booster shot if you want to make sure that you feel extra comfortable this holiday season.
I was going to just say, oh, go ahead, Katie.
Sorry. I was just going to say real quick, one statistic that really stood out to me is that over the past 2 weeks in Mecklenburg County, about 28% of total cases of COVID-19 were among children. And about half of those cases were in kids 5 to 11 who are, of course, eligible for the vaccine. It could be the type of thing where parents maybe are hesitant about the vaccine and are not going to, you know, heed experts' advice to get their kids vaccinated until their kid gets it or until they have to hold their kid back from school for a couple weeks or whatever the quarantine period is now, until it like hits home. So I think that those numbers among kids are pretty staggering and quite frankly, a little bit frightening.
And I was going to say, go ahead, Mike. Sorry. Well, I was going to say what Mary said earlier about, you know, this pent-up demand and about people to get together. And I think that, you know, kind of as a society, we are just moving into this phase of learning to live with this. I mean, if you look up in the Northeast where we talked about cases are going up because of the cold weather, there's states that have vaccination rates much, much higher than Mecklenburg County. You know, places like Maine and New Hampshire, they're seeing these big surges. And I think the key thing is we keep moving to this point of kind of learning to live with it as best we can. And, you know, masks, if we stick with the 5% rule, test positivity, the mask mandate, it may be in place until May. I mean, that may be, and it may peel off for a couple of weeks and come right back. So I just think it's a kind of a new normal.
I heard one health official yesterday say they didn't think we would be able to return to anything approaching normal and even go back to the office until April. And Gibby Harris told me the other night that she thinks that we're going to be getting these COVID shots like we get the flu shot from now on. North Carolina has been operating without a state budget since mid-2019. We're the only state in the nation without a budget. But that has changed as of last night because Governor Cooper has signed the long-debated budget because he says the good outweighs the bad, but he's not totally happy with it.
While I believe that it is a budget of some missed opportunities and misguided policy, it's also a budget that we desperately need at this unique time in the history of our state.
He signed this budget last night, Steve, I think, and he wasn't scheduled to sign it until Tuesday. Why did he push it ahead?
You know, I'm not sure why he moved it forward. I guess there was probably, you could argue that it wasn't a particular, let's go ahead and get this done with, because like he said, let's get this done with and let's get it kind of out of the news cycle, because for Democrats, there were a lot of missed opportunities. I mean, there is, again, no Medicaid expansion. North Carolina is just one of handful of states that have not done that. And when you look at the budget, you have almost all Democrats in the House and Senate voted for this. But it to me seems more of a Republican win than a true compromise. There are, again, no Medicaid expansion. There are significant tax cuts. There are some provisions in the budget that the governor bitterly opposed, that one, you know, kind of reining in his emergency powers for things like COVID, and he agreed to sign it, but fight those later. So I think you could maybe say, like, let's get this signed and move on.
Well, you know, he's never signed a budget before since coming to office, evidently, because he vetoed the first budget that was presented to him and it was passed over his veto. He could have vetoed again. He could have allowed it to go into law without signing it, but he chose to sign it. What does that tell us?
I think there's one thing that if you kind of look at last year's election results, if you're an elected Democrat in the state, last year's results, Republicans had a pretty good year statewide. And I think there's a sense that the wind, if you're a Democrat, the wind is not behind your backs in the state right now. And I think there has been a bit of a shift, especially as we move into 2022 elections. And I think maybe there's a bit of kind of facing political reality a little bit the governor's not on the ballot, of course, but for other Democrats, there's a bit of an acknowledgement this is going to be a very difficult environment for them.
And I think there was even a question, since there are some Democrats that were supporting it, that perhaps there wouldn't be enough support for him, that, that Democrats were going to help to get this budget passed anyway. So, as you say, Steve, maybe the support just wasn't there from folks who are looking at their seats and Democrats saying, looks pretty good to me.
The Charlotte Observer has an interesting article today about the back and forth. Somehow they got their hands on the confidential back and forth between the governor and the legislative leaders about what they were haggling over to get this thing done. But what we have ended up with are raises and bonuses for teachers and state employees, a $15 per hour pay floor beginning next year for local school employees who are not teachers, and $5.9 billion for state agencies and higher education building projects. Any other things of note that people should be aware of in this budget?
I think they're also really excited about the broadband expansion. I think there was like $1 billion for broadband announced statewide. There are cuts to personal income tax rates, bonuses for teachers using federal funds. While there are, these raises for teachers, there are teacher groups, of course, who say that this is not sufficient enough, and who say that there should have been more done for the state's educators.
Well, they are cutting individual taxes from, 5.25% to 3.99% beginning next year. But the corporate tax will go away completely by 2025. We have a lot of infrastructure needs in this state and a lot of educational needs in this state. How do we pay for all this if the corporations aren't paying any taxes and we've lowered the individual tax rate to boot?
I think that's a good question, Mike. Republicans are going to point out that under their watch, they've been able to grow the surplus in the budget. They're, this is, of course, is kind of the classic argument of, they believe low taxes fuels growth, which fuels tax revenue. That has worked for the past few years under a booming economy. The question will be, will that continue?
Why not keep the corporate tax where it is and cut the individual tax to zero?
Again, that's a good
question.
I know that
vote.
I think now with the individual rate, $25,000, there'll be, that's kind of the, if you make under 25, there's no state income tax. So I guess in a way they've done that. But yes, to your point, that's again part of this overall debate.
And we will also pass up, once again, money for Medicaid, the chance to expand Medicaid to hundreds of thousands of low-income adults. This money comes from the federal government, tax dollars paid by North Carolinians to the federal government pay for this, and we're saying no to it yet again. What excuse are they using this time for taking that tact in 30 seconds or less?
They're sending it to a committee, Mike. That was kind of their compromise. It's going to be studied more, so Cooper can hang on to that.
Does it need to be studied more? We've been looking at this now since Obamacare became a reality. Does it need to be studied more?
It's more than nothing.
Okay. We have to take a break. We'll come back, talk more politics. Some as the districts are being redrawn and the map and candidates are being shuffled, we'll talk about the impact of that and more as Charlotte Talks continues. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on the Local News Roundup on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Steve Harrison is here. He's our political reporter here at WFAE News. Mary C. Curtis writes about politics and more for Roll Call, and she is the host of their Equal Time podcast. Joe Bruno is with us from Channel 9, and Katie Peralta-Soloff from Axios Charlotte. Redistricting is underway. Surprise, surprise. New voting maps have been drawn. A lawsuit has already been filed over the maps drawn by city council for those races. A lawsuit has also been filed challenging the state's maps for both Congress and the state legislature, alleging both racial and partisan gerrymandering. Racial gerrymandering, of course, is illegal, and according to the U.S. Supreme Court. Partisan gerrymandering is not, though it does intersect with race. What's the thrust of this lawsuit in North Carolina, or these lawsuits in North Carolina? Steve?
Well, like you said, lawsuits, there are multiple, and the general feeling is that, like you said, that partisan gerrymandering is technically allowed by the U.S. Supreme Court, but these will be contested in state court as well. And there is a sense among the plaintiffs that that the legislature has unfairly targeted Black voters in drawing the new congressional map. The biggest kind of case would be that Northeast North Carolina seat that's represented by G.K. Butterfield, who has announced this week he will not run for re-election. The number of Black voters in that district lowered slightly and made it much more difficult for him to be re-elected. He is, of course, a African-American member in the state's delegation. So kind of already seeing some of the impact of the new map.
And a high ranking.
He was at one point the head of the Congressional Black Caucus. And this is really the reason why you see so many voting rights advocates, as well as folks who say they're interested in democracy, as National Urban League President Mark Morial did on my podcast this week, that say these federal voting rights legislation and these laws that Republicans are pretty much blocking in Washington need to be passed. Because while there are lawsuits, in the meantime, these maps are going to go into effect. We'll have primaries and we'll have elections, and it's very hard to pull back. You see this happening not just in North Carolina, in Ohio, in Georgia, all states that are pretty 50-50, pretty split. But you'll see that Republicans obviously are drawing them, so they're truly skewed in their favor. And there is so much pushback because racial gerrymandering is illegal, but partisan is allowed. And in so many states, they kind of line up where you see that most Republicans, it's a party of predominantly of White's party.
Congressman Butterfield has been there for a long time. I think he's 74 years old.
74.
I don't think he's necessarily given the reason he's not running again, but he's pretty powerful. He's a ranking Democrat. So was it likely that he would not have been reelected had he stayed in the race because of the way these districts have been drawn? Is he just retiring because, in his mind, it's time? And what will the impact to North Carolina be of his disappearance? Because whoever takes his place, Democrat or Republican, will be junior. They will not be at the senior levels of Democratic power in Congress.
I think that the seat that he has been drawn into is still leans Democratic. I think that's important to say. It has gotten much more purple, and it's gone from a safe Democratic seat to one that either party can win. And when you look ahead, so I think what was going through his mind is, one, I'm in a much tougher seat. And two, this is probably shaping up to be a terrible year for Democrats. So if it was a 2018 year in this seat, you know, a blue wave, he'd probably win re-election pretty easily.
Well, let me ask you about that, because he's not the only Democrat who's retiring and deciding not to run again because it might be a terrible year for Democrats. Are they making it a self-fulfilling prophecy? They're known commodities. It's easier for incumbents to be elected than newcomers to be elected. Are they helping the Republican wave here?
Yeah, I think you could make that argument. I mean, if you go back to like 2017 and there were a lot of Republican retirements, and it kind of definitely feeds into a media narrative when incumbents start stepping down, and it kind of builds this narrative of like, it's going to be a terrible year for Republicans. And now we're kind of seeing that same thing going into 2022, where, you know, it's people don't want to go out a loser. I mean, you don't want to lose your last election. That would be such a downer for your career. So a lot of people are saying like Butterfield, I'm 74, it's time.
Yeah.
Well, it's already a tough year. it always is a tough year for the party in the White House. But of course, Joe Biden's numbers are down. It's not looking good for Democrats. And also, it looks as though Republicans really aren't being punished for the most part, being supportive of or trying to ignore an insurrection on January the 6th. Look at the last elections in Virginia.
Well, that, I would make the argument that that's the Democrats' fault because they're not moving aggressively or quickly enough if they're really serious about rescuing what they see as a democracy in jeopardy. The new congressional maps that North Carolina has drawn kind of monkey with a lot of different districts and with some incumbents, as we've just talked about, but also Madison Cawthorn. He is the youngest and arguably the most radical conservative member of Congress, an ardent Trumper. He continues to support the big lie, going so far as to warn of the need to take up arms and cautioning that future, quote, rigged, end quote, elections would lead to bloodshed. He's represented the 11th district. He's moving now, I think, to the 13th district. Why?
Well, so go you take this one, Joe.
Well, he says that his district was split in two, which it was, but almost all of the counties are in the 14th district. I think only two of his old counties are in the 13th district, and where he lives isn't too far from the 13th district. So that's why, that's one way he justified it. The other way, he said he wants to ensure that there's a strong conservative candidate in the 13th district, and he took a thin shot probably at Tim Moore by saying that there was a good chance the 13th district would elect an establishment Republican who would just go along,
aka Tim Moore.
You know, I'm not sure if Tim Moore is that. I don't know if that's a proper way to describe Tim Moore, but that is what he said.
Well, I think that's a signal of where the Republican Party is now. I mean, they were probably a little mad at him, too. That district, wasn't it carved out pretty much for Tim Moore, the House Speaker, to take on? And Matthew Cawthorn really is not known for, I don't think his name is on legislation or anything like that. It's more he's this firebrand, and it just shows how really far to the right the Republican Party has moved.
He will have competition. Go ahead, Steve. I'm sorry.
I was just going to say one more thing. You know, kind of, Mayor, you talked about him, you know, angering a lot of Republicans by taking that Tim Moore seat, which is true. I think if you know, we're going to court over these, this congressional map, if the kind of the Democratic aligned groups win and the General Assembly has to draw new maps in 2023 or 2022, they will punish Madison Cawthorn. They can easily redraw this new seat that he's moved over to. They can dump a lot of Democrats from Mecklenburg County in it. Because, yeah, he kind of broke the code in switching seats. And so I think there'll be it'll be very easy for them to punish him. And after this switch, I think a lot of people would like to see him just vanish.
Joe.
But I will say, if it's 2023, 2022, and they're redrawing the map and they're trying to punish Madison Cawthorn, it might be a moot point, because by that point, Madison Cawthorn might be trying to run for governor or lieutenant governor.
He will have competition in this race from a Democrat named Josh Remillard, who lives in the 14th district, but who also will live in the will run in the 13th. Candidates for Congress do not have to live in the district in which they represent, which is weird to me, but that's the truth. And Mr. Remillard has said Cawthorn is uniquely dangerous and needs to be removed, and that's exactly what he intends on doing. Is it unusual for people running for Congress to talk about their opponents that way, as uniquely dangerous?
Not really. Now it is.
Well, Mo Davis was, when he ran against Madison Cawthorn last year, he had some pointed attacks on him. So I think that can be kind of expected. I will say, though, this seat, it would be a shocker if a Democrat could beat the Republican candidate in this seat. So if people are opposed to Madison Cawthorn and don't want him to be the representative, their best shot is in the primary.
So Mary, go ahead, Steve.
I was going to say, I think one reason why Madison may have switched from the seat in the mountains in Asheville to the seat kind of in Gaston, Cleveland County, is that his existing seat added Watauga County with App State. it became a little more democratic this time. He'd probably win it in 2022, but at some point this decade, there'll be a blue wave, right? We'll have some kind of backlash to that's going to happen. His existing seat, he could lose. This new seat in Gaston and Rutherford, Cleveland County, it's like a Republican plus 20. Whoever gets that, like Joe said, a Democrat is not winning. No way.
Okay. All right. Mary, a little political, national political perspective here, because Democrats in Congress just censured Arizona Republican Congressman Paul Gosar, who is unapologetic for tweeting out a violent video depicting him murdering Democratic Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and committing an act of violence against President Biden. He retweeted that video immediately after he was censured by Congress and stripped of his committee assignments. Republicans are standing by him and treating him like a martyr. Marjorie Taylor Greene from Georgia has also been stripped of her committee assignments. The question is why Democrats have not acted similarly against Madison Cawthorn, who spoke at the January 6th rally that led to the insurrection at the Capitol and who seems to foment violence on a regular basis. Why are they ignoring him?
Well, I'm not sure. Stand in line, I guess. You have so many people who are committing these egregious transgressions. Some are saying that Republicans are sort of threatening, when we are in power, we're going to do the same thing.
And believe
folks
them.
Folks like Maxine Waters and Ilhan Omar and other.
Believe
and Nancy Pelosi
them.
Said, I'm sorry. Yes. But believe the thing of it is Nancy Pelosi says, well, they would do it anyway. It doesn't matter. And you were talking about how we are talking about our opponents. Well, this is the new norm. It's not just people who disagree with you. They are evil people. They are bad people. And so you see even members of Paul Gosar's family are saying this is a dangerous person. But he is getting elected in Arizona because he has an R after his name.
Yeah, his family has come. His family did a television commercial, many members of his family, opposing his election down there. A lot of people are really concerned, Mary, about the state of our democracy, with justification, and its prospects for survival. And this is just another example, I think, of why. But for your podcast, you spoke with civil rights leader and National Urban League President Mark Morial, who told you that he is, quote, damn worried about the democracy. What were his reasons for concern?
Well, he talks about how partisan it is. He talks about the fact that so many of these voting laws and redistricting and restrictions on voting are getting it to the point where actually politicians are totally picking their voters and not the other way around. And he is worried about it getting entrenched. And I think he's worried also that, you know, it's true that Joe Biden and the National Democrats are saying, you know, I want to get this economic agenda passed. We will deal with voting rights. Maybe we will have a carve out of the filibuster. Maybe we won't. We don't want to deal with the. And he's basically saying, you know, the filibuster is this tradition, but it's not really a rule. And if it stands in the way of getting voting legislation passed, the Freedom to Vote Act, the John Lewis Voting Advancement Act passed, then that's something you have to deal with now. Because if these new rules stand, if these laws stand, that some of them say, even after the vote is taken, partisan legislatures will be able to change the results, that we are in danger of losing democracy. So he and a group, the Urban League and a group of many other civil rights organizations put together this scorecard, you know, saying, look at your senators, look at your representatives, and take them to account.
Speaking of voting rights, former Georgia gubernatorial candidate and voting rights advocate, Democratic star Stacey Abrams is making a multi-city tour, and she made a stop here in Charlotte. She told WBTV's QC at 3 why she chose to come here.
Charlotte is one of those cities that I think it's so critical to the story of who we are. It has a diverse population that is reflective of the kind of transformation we're watching this nation go through. And it's a lovely place. I'm happy to come.
So why the tour, Mary? You were at her Charlotte appearance, and she told WBTV's Dedrick Russell that she'd be doing a lot of listening. But what did she talk about? Why is she doing this tour?
Well, I mean, I think people, after she lost that Georgia gubernatorial race, that was, you know, a lot of voters were purged. It was the one in which the Republican candidate was the Secretary of State. He was in charge of the voting process. People expected her to go away. But what she did was she became the activist. She started Fair Fight, Fair Count, She started working particularly in the South with organizations, including in North Carolina, to make sure people were registered and get out to vote. And she talked a lot about that, about the fact that, you know, what did she say? Voting isn't magic, it's medicine. You have to do it to get things done. And she encouraged people to get involved. And you know, she also talked about her, she's an author, she's a an entrepreneur. She talked about all of these things. And she talked about, yes, she has failed in things. And she said, don't be afraid of that failure, that if you've never failed, you haven't done anything. So she is that inspirational figure. And I think part of she's doing the tour is she's a Democratic rock star. You haven't seen the last of her.
So 2 weeks ago, five students were arrested. Two guns were found, one of them stolen, during an altercation at Hopewell High School. At last week's school board meeting, a lot of parents were extremely upset and wanted lots of answers from Superintendent Ernest Winston and others about what they were going to do about all this. And this week, a couple of hundred of those parents gathered for a town hall meeting to talk about the incident and what they want from CMS in the aftermath. Joe, you were there. What was discussed?
Well, the superintendent offered some commitments that they are investigating or studying certain safety measures that have been asked for by parents. And they include metal detectors, clear backpacks, wanding, increased community partnerships, and increases in campus security. Did not offer a timeline, though, for when this could be implemented.
Some parents want more defenses erected. Others don't. Hopewell parent David Mullally told CMS officials that the school needs metal detectors.
Let's focus on the real issues so no one has to lose a kid the next time there's an argument in a hallway.
But another parent said he didn't want his children living in a prison.
We don't need to swing the pendulum so far the other way that our kids are, you know, living in barbed wire and being wanded.
You know what struck me about those two pieces of tape? With all of the stuff going on at school boards around the country and the importance of this discussion, they were calm and logical and they weren't screaming. How do you explain that, Joe? I got 10 seconds. How do you explain that?
It was a nice meeting, and I think people were truly there to try to find a solution. And I am proud of the way that the crowd handled itself. Went a little off the rails toward the end, but it was a successful night.
So we'll talk a little bit more about that when we come back from the break, and we'll also get into what's going on in the county and with Atrium Innovation District. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE at WFHE. I'm Mike Collins, the local news roundup with Steve Harrison from WFAE News, Mary C. Curtis from Roll Call, Katie Peralta-Sola from Axia Charlotte, and Joe Bruno from Channel 9 WSOC-TV. You were at that school meeting at Hopewell where they were discussing the need for security because they found guns in those schools, in that school and other schools around Mecklenburg. Some parents wanted tighter security. Other parents wanted to make sure it wasn't a prison. Which side of that argument seemed to have the most number of partisans?
Increased security, I think. They had the most representatives at the meeting. But I want to say one interesting thing from it. Clear backpacks. CMS would purchase them for all students. And we learned that if CMS puts this policy in place, it wouldn't be until likely January because of the supply chain issues. All those backpacks come from China. They wouldn't be able to get them in fast enough.
And CMS Superintendent Ernest Winston was there. He proposed several different security enhancements, clear backpacks being one, metal detectors, wanding, increased campus security, community partnerships. There's already one underway. A couple of weeks ago, Rhonda Cheek, a school board member, announced that Hopewell would start piloting a program called Dads on Duty. It's a national program in which fathers come into the school, and it seems to have met with success elsewhere. But what about these metal detectors? I thought we had decided in the aftermath of the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas shooting that that they were not practical at CMS.
Yeah, I don't know how seriously they are being considered, but the superintendent said that they are studying the issue.
So at this week's county commission meeting, the health department announced they would be closing The isolation and quarantine hotel on December 31st. That hotel opened in March of 2020 to provide rooms for people without housing who were recovering from COVID-19 and quarantining after exposure. It cost the county $300,000 a month. That's $6.3 million over 21 months. The money was to cover the lease, food, security, cleaning. How many people have used that hotel over the past 21 months, Joe?
Early on in the pandemic, it was crowded. It was a steady crowd, steady mm-hmm. flow of people in there, especially as people were learning how to handle COVID and handle outbreaks. Really, the only reason you would stay there is if you do not have a safe place to quarantine. Maybe you don't have a home. Maybe you're trapped in Charlotte and you can't get back to right. where you're actually going, and you don't want to shell out money for an Airbnb or private room in that regard. You can stay at this hotel. But right now, there's one guy in it.
Yeah, one guy. Over the last week, there have been 3 days or several days with no occupants. The maximum number of occupants at one time lately has been 10 people, according to County Health Director Gibby Harris. That's not very cost effective, you think? But the money, I think, is the money being reimbursed by FEMA? Are they paying for this?
Yeah, it's from FEMA, the funding. But so when the county, when that funding runs out at the end of December, the county isn't going to.
So if one person is there at the moment, why are they closing? Why are they waiting till December 31st to close it?
It comes down to FEMA providing the funding for this. But if a shelter has to be able to handle one person having COVID, being able to isolate them, that's the whole point of all this, Gibby says.
So, Katie, we know a little bit more about what Atrium Health is envisioning for their innovation district, which we've been talking about now for a couple of weeks. It's their soon-to-be-constructed medical school and its environs on Baxter and McDowell and Kenilworth. Aside from the school, what are they planning?
So it's going to be sort of a community asset, as they're describing it as. It'll have public plazas, ground floor retail, where they hope to have, you know, local businesses come in, shops, restaurants, cafes. Neighbors in the area are pushing for a lot more than just sort of what can serve what they see as sort of a higher income group in the area. They want to see things like more affordable housing. Currently, the plan calls for about 5% of affordable housing on site, as well as a hotel. I didn't mention that yet. so this plan is still very much in the works, and they are taking community feedback quite seriously because they are asking for a lot of taxpayer money to fund it.
And they're getting it. Well, the $75 million is what they're asking for from the county and the city combined. And they got some pushback already because this project will cross over both Kenilworth, McDowell, and both sides of Baxter into the Cherry neighborhood, which is also already being gentrified. And a representative from that area, Sylvia Biddle Patton, pushed this council for more affordable housing in those apartment units. Right now they're offering 5%. Of 350 units, or about 17 units of affordable housing. And I asked Mayor Lyles on the program here on Wednesday about leverage, because if Atrium is asking for tax breaks for the project, the city must have some leverage right now in getting more affordable housing in that area.
I think yes. I think that if you're going to have 5,000 jobs that are going to be at a price point where people are going to not require a four-year degree to work there, we need to have access to affordable housing. I think it's something that we continue to negotiate and look at. I also believe that we've just got to figure out a way to make sure that people don't have to have a car to go to work to live in our city.
So given our past track record, how successful might the city be at using this moment in time? You want to build this stuff? Oh, you want $75 million? Okay, let's build some affordable housing. How much leverage do you think they have, and will they even push it?
Well, the city's vote is on Monday. So if those talks are happening, they're happening behind the scenes. I guess we'll get an update on Monday. But I will say this, when Atrium presented to the city, it was more like, here's our checkbook, where do we sign? It was the county doing all of the pushback.
Yes.
So if more affordable housing is landed out of this deal, I think the county will be the reason why.
Okay.
I'll say, Dreams, Go ahead, Katie.
Sorry, go. I was just going to say Atrium has been receptive to these requests from the community, but they also did point out that they donated a bunch of land on North Tryon right near Noda Brewing for affordable housing, sort of kind of more broadly speaking to its commitment to affordable housing. I guess last week, maybe a couple weeks ago, I can't remember when it was, but Atrium executives pointed out, you know, when companies like Centene come to town, you're not asking them about affordable housing either. So it's sort of a, it's an ongoing controversy, if you will. I think that the other thing to point out is even if Atrium does donate all this other space for affordable housing, how do you get people from North Tryon all the way to Midtown? It's not like our bus system is going to effectively, you know, fix itself overnight and get people from A to B in 12 minutes. It's just not, that's not going to happen.
Okay, we'll watch that next week. McRae Dallas, the man at the center of the 9th District election fraud scandal, pled not guilty to charges in that case this week. Joe, you were there at, I think, Wake County in the courtroom. This is a roll of the dice for him, isn't it?
It is, because he faces many years in prison if he is found guilty. And the prosecutor offered, or the DA offered, a one-year deal. And you'll be able to use 6 of those months with your current federal sentence. So really just an extra 6 months for him to plead guilty, but he turned it down.
Wow. So he's rolling the dice for a trial that will start in late August. This whole thing dates back to 2018 when Mark Harris, the Republican, was running against Dan McCready, the Democrat. He won. Mark Harris won by 905 votes, but that whole election was thrown out because of what McRae Dallas is accused of doing, and that is manipulating absentee ballots. And, of course, the redo led to the election of Dan Bishop. Although Republicans allege that this sort of shenanigans is running rampant across the country, it is not. And this is one of the few cases in which it can be documented. And Wake County District Attorney Lauren Freeman told Channel 9 why it is important that this case be prosecuted.
You know, the allegations that have been, that have risen out of this investigation all along, have centered around, you know, election activity and maintaining the integrity of the election system. And that is something that the state of North Carolina has a very strong interest in.
So this has been going on since, 2019, and he's already in jail on unrelated charges. Why do we have to wait? Why does he have to wait until late August of 2022 for his trial to begin on this?
They wanted the trial to start after he serves his 6-month prison sentence for social security fraud. He's reporting to prison on December 1st, but he has asked if he can extend that time to April due to health challenges.
Okay. Congress finally passed and President Biden signed into law one of the most significant infrastructure bills in decades. The money's in the trillions. How much is North Carolina slated to get, Katie, and how is it likely to be used?
So North Carolina roads and highways set to receive about $7.2 billion. Sorry, I just had to pull up this number because I couldn't remember it.
Okay.
Over the next 5 years. This is important because we have about 3,000 miles of highways that are considered in poor conditions. So they obviously have a long list of projects that need addressing with some of this funding. Also of note here in Charlotte specifically, one thing that got a lot of attention is the Charlotte Gateway Station is going to get $15 million from the plan. That's something that Tom Tillis shared on Twitter this week. The Gateway Station, of course, is going to be this, you know, major project, kind of walkable to a lot of different parts of uptown Charlotte. It'll replace the existing transit center and have everything in this sort of new state of the art facility in uptown.
Will anything in this money that's coming to North Carolina from this infrastructure bill be visible, I guess, by November of this year for this coming year for the election?
I think Democrats will try to find a way to do that. They need a win ahead of November.
We found out a day or so ago that in order to buy a home in Charlotte, Katie, you have to earn at least almost $80,000 a year. That prices a lot of people out of home ownership, and it puts the term affordable housing in a whole new light. What are the implications of that price tag for the region and for people coming here?
Yeah. So as sort of this growing, New South hotspot, I guess Charlotte has this reputation, at least compared with other major cities like San Francisco and New York, as being this affordable place with, you know, very temperate weather, et cetera. Our crazy housing market is really starting to question that narrative about how affordable we are, because as this new UNC Charlotte study this week pointed out, the pandemic really has exacerbated our affordable housing crisis. Between September of 2020 and this September, the median home and rental prices in Charlotte both increased by about 16%, which is a pretty staggering increase. Of course, that outpaces increases in wages pretty significantly. The median home price here was about $335,000, also far out of the price range of a lot of people. Starter homes, I guess you'd consider, those first homes that people are looking for under the $300,000 price point are becoming really hard to find. About 35% of those homes sold for under $300,000 last year. And then last year, almost half of homes sold for under that amount. So it's becoming harder to afford living here, both in terms of rental costs and home ownership.
So that's for people living here, people coming here, but there are a lot of people coming and going this week because of the Thanksgiving holiday. And I know the airport's going to be particularly busy. What are they expecting out there, Katie? Katie, unmute yourself.
Sorry about that.
Okay.
The numbers that Charlotte Douglas are reporting are not quite as busy as 2019, but it is still expected to be a pretty hectic travel season, as it is every year. So at Charlotte Douglas, officials had a bunch of members of the media in this week, including my colleague Ashley Mahoney, to talk about sort of tips and best practices. This year they're expecting something like 35,000 people. So you're asked to be kind and get to the airport 2 hours early, that kind of thing.
Okay. Some bad news to report this week. Dr. Ophelia Garman Brown died from cancer this week. She was a Charlotte physician, minister, author, champion of the underserved. Mary, I'm sure you knew her. Talk about her for a second.
She was a wonderful person. It's hard to state how much she meant to the community. She co-founded the Charlotte Community Health Center. It served poor and uninsured people. She volunteered at the Charlotte Pregnancy Center. She traveled as a medical missionary all over the world. And she has been fighting cancer, as everyone in the community knows, for so long. And she wrote a book, The Unexpected Gift, Profiles in Courage from Cancer Survivorship, seeing how her story could help others.
And despite the fact that she was a woman of, the fact that she was a woman of great personal accomplishment, she was also selfless. And she explained her motivation for acting that way in a promotional, a video produced by Novant to observe her passing.
One of the things I have come to appreciate, especially as I have lived with cancer, we are here not for ourselves, but we are here for others. When I see people that have a need, there is really something inside of me that says, I need to help.
And we end on a happier note. It happened last Sunday in Arizona, where Superman returned. I'm talking about Cam Newton. He returned as quarterback for the Panthers, helped them win 34-10 over the Cardinals. And in typical Cam fashion, he did a little celebrating in the end zone. Let's go to the play-by-play.
McCaffrey split out wide to the right. Newton takes the snap, and he is in for a Panthers touchdown.
Yep, he's back. I hope he can keep it up. We'll see what happens. That's the end of it. That's all we have time for this morning. Steve Harrison from WFAE News, Joe Bruno from WSOC-TV, Mary C. Curtis, columnist for Roll Call, host of their Equal Time podcast, and Katie Peralta-Sola from Axios Charlotte. Thank you all for the hour. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, pledging to help end child hunger in the Carolinas through ongoing support of Second Harvest Food Bank of Metrolina. Details about this initiative at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.